And for the second part of our discussion, which is quite appropriate, really, because although Warship Sci-Far is a UK-based international magazine, we do publish two specials. That's the Guide to the Royal Navy and a Guide to the US Navy, because as Emma and I discussed, it's a very important organisation that is pivotal to world security. And so as David is actually out and about at the moment, on the move, somewhere over there in the USA, we asked him to pre-record some answers, touching on the same topics, answering some of the same questions as Emma, and giving us his pearls of wisdom, because David also has made a major contribution to the current Guide to the US Navy, the Guide to US Navy 2025. So it's good to hear him actually provide some insights and background on what he thinks to the state of the American Navy as we head off into a new year. David, as we head into 2025, what overall state do you think the US Navy is in?
The overall state of the US Navy in 2025 is going to be pretty dire. It's a fleet that has stagnated on a number of fronts. We're seeing struggles in shipbuilding, struggles in recruiting, struggles in getting key vessels out to sea for deployments on time and in sufficient numbers. And a lot of this is, these are problems that have been long in development, many of which were accelerated by the COVID pandemic, specifically the labor crisis in the shipbuilding industry, which is the main reason the fleet can't grow right now. And COVID also disrupted recruitment, which has had a lingering effect on the Navy's ability to simply get sailors onto ships and get them out to sea. So we are seeing a Navy that is, at best, holding the line in terms of force structure and combat power at a time when it should be growing.
With Donald Trump due to take office as president for a second time in January, what do you think are the chances of the U.S. military pulling out of NATO?
So Donald Trump has always been a skeptic of NATO. He seems to think that NATO is some kind of business relationship between countries where the United States pays, in effect, for the alliance, for member states' defense, or sometimes he'll describe it as the United States providing a service, national defense in exchange for money. And when he describes it as the latter, he often gripes that NATO countries aren't paying enough to the United States for its security services. Of course, NATO is not some kind of business deal. NATO is an alliance of mutually supporting countries that, agree to operate under a shared framework with shared goals. Trump is right that many NATO countries haven't contributed enough to their own defense, which of course would, have the effect of also bolstering the alliance's alliance-wide capabilities. But that is a problem that long predates Trump and will linger even when Trump is dead and gone. NATO countries, on the average, have been increasing their defense spending as a share of GDP to bring it up to the near-term goal of 2%. And that also is a phenomenon that long predates Trump and will continue as Trump is gone, after Trump is gone. So will Trump pull the United States out of NATO? I think there would be massive congressional resistance to that happening. So I don't think that Trump will be able politically to withdraw the United States from NATO. But there's a lot of tinkering on the margins he could do to the U.S.-NATO relationship that could cause a lot of harm to the alliance. More importantly, Trump has promised to impose massive tariffs on pretty much all of the United States' major trading partners immediately on taking office, and that could have a catastrophic effect on the U.S. economy, which would have a catastrophic effect on U.S. defense spending, which would sap U.S. military power and pull NATO down with it. So I think the threat of Trump pulling the United States out of NATO is not as serious as the threat of Trump simply weakening the United States and weakening NATO by extension.
Even if it didn't happen, even if the US didn't pull out of NATO altogether, do you reckon he'll scale back the number of destroyers committed to being forward based at Rota in Spain? I mean, President Biden raised the number there from 4 to 6, and I think there's five operating from Rota at the moment. So might Donald Trump axe them or cut them back?
So, with Trump, it's important not to fixate on details because he doesn't fixate on details. Will Trump pull destroyers out of Spain? Honestly, he's not gonna. He doesn't know that there are destroyers in Spain. He doesn't care that there are destroyers in Spain. That's gonna be a decision that that his Pentagon nominees, his nominee for Secretary of the Navy. May weigh on, but even they may not be super detail-oriented people if they're Trump's picks. So I wouldn't worry about, the fine details of force structure and forward deployments. I'd worry more about the macro details of, possible American military decline in a second Trump term, which would be far more damaging than shifting a few destroyers this way or that.
Or might there be fewer deployments by carriers and amphibious ships to the Sixth Fleet, the fleet that operates around Europe and off North Africa, out in the Atlantic and the Med? Or could Trump axe the Aegis ashore bases in Poland and Romania that Russia objects to so vociferously, those ballistic missile defense bases that are run by the US Navy on land?
Right. So what Trump does with military policies and capabilities and deployments vis-a-vis Russia is going to hinge on what happens in Ukraine. Trump has pledged to, well, he pledged to end the war in Ukraine within a day of being elected. That was in November. That didn't happen. He's made lots of promises about ending that war somehow unilaterally and doing it immediately on his election or his inauguration. The tentative peace ceasefire overtures that Trump has made to Putin or has mentioned in passing to Zelensky don't seem to be landing with either audience, which shouldn't surprise anyone because negotiating a business deal is not the same as nudging compelling Russia to agree to a ceasefire in Ukraine. It should be very clear by now that the regime of Vladimir Putin is 100% committed to achieving maximal goals in Ukraine, which I would say at this point is the full Russian occupation of eastern Ukraine, specifically Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. The latter is already under full Russian occupation. The former isn't quite yet. And Putin is not going to agree to a ceasefire absent full control of that part of Ukraine. Again, he's not there yet. Maybe he'll get there in the coming year, albeit at great cost. Unless Trump somehow can compel Ukraine to surrender that territory to Russia, there isn't going to be a ceasefire. And Trump seems to forget that Ukraine has agency and allies who aren't Americans. And there's almost no scenario, imaginable scenario, where Ukraine simply gives up a significant portion of its territory because Trump tells it to. So, what's going to happen in Ukraine is in my view, that Trump is going to talk big about making a ceasefire happen, fail, and be embarrassed. And his reaction to that embarrassment is what's going to be critical. Will he react to that embarrassment by retroactively redefining what he ever said and wanted in Ukraine and maintaining some sort of, I don't know, lower level of half-hearted support for Ukraine? Or will he react by being so furious at Vladimir Putin for not buying his BS that he maintained strong U.S. support for Ukraine? The latter scenario isn't inconceivable, and it will all hinge on Donald Trump's feelings. So the Aegis deployments in Spain and Romania, in as much as they are targeting Russia, which I would argue that they are not, even though the Russians seem to view it that way, will sort of ride on that, on those politics. We will know very soon after Trump's inauguration what's going to happen with the United States, Ukraine, and Russia. And we, you know, we'll see deployments like those in Spain, sort of any possible changes flow from those politics.
Looking at the Middle East, how do you think the US-led campaign to stop or at least tamp down on the Houthi rebels of Yemen firing missiles and drones at merchant shipping is going?
So the U.S. naval campaign around Yemen is at best containing the Houthis by shooting down at extreme cost to the Americans, you know, a significant number of Houthi drones and missiles. And you've seen U.S. air and missile strikes targeting the Houthi rebel infrastructure, probably not to great effect. This is not a conflict that shows any sign of ending, ending by virtue of, you know, U.S. military intervention. What's going to alter the dynamics of that conflict is Iran. The Houthis cannot sustain their campaign without Iranian support, and the Iranians are kind of in a corner right now, what with the collapse of their ally, the al-Assad regime in Syria. So I'll be waiting in the next few months to see how Iranian power projection changes with the Syrian regime's defeat, and whether that has any effect on the Houthi missile and drone campaign. But I don't think U.S. naval intervention is making much of a difference. It's simply mitigating some of the worst damage. Whether Trump would lean on the Navy to curtail those deployments, I don't know. It's not an enormous drain on U.S. military capabilities. I'm not super pleased with the drawdown in missile inventories, but you know, it's not like the counter Houthi campaign is going to make or break U.S. naval capabilities in the coming year. Again, look to the politics. Don't look to the particular capabilities. If the chaos of the Syrian collapse weighs on Iranian power projection, then we may see slipping support for the Houthis, and that is what would make a difference with the counter shipping campaign.
Can even the U.S. Navy, which is a mighty force, sustain such a commitment and expenditure of munitions? It's a lot of missiles being fired off to try and handle the Houthis.
So we are right to be concerned about the expenditure of munitions. It has been a priority in the U.S. Navy for years to build up stockpiles of the most expensive long-range munitions, your SM-6s, your cruise missiles, your SM-3s, and it's not super encouraging to see those munitions being expended on, you know, some makeshift rocket launchers in Yemen. We need those munitions for great power conflict, specifically for conflict in the Western Pacific. So, I mean, are current procurement rates adequate to sustain the counter Houthi campaign and also build up arsenals? Maybe, but just barely. Yeah, the U.S. Navy needs to do a lot more to build up those inventories, especially as it continues plucking at Houthi drones over the Red Sea.
Looking to Indo-Pacific, what are the chances of China invading Taiwan in 2027, do you think? Some are suggesting that, and would the U.S. Navy lose that battle if it happens?
So there seems to be a growing consensus that China is aiming to make a move on Taiwan before 2027. All you have to do is listen to the Chinese to believe that that is a serious possibility. Could the U.S. Navy lose? Of course, the U.S. Navy could lose. The inflection point in that balance of power was many, many years ago. The Chinese Navy, Air Force, Rocket Force, Army, and Marine Corps have grown and modernized at a breathtaking pace in the past generation. And in many key capabilities and capacities match, if not exceed, U.S. Navy forces in the region. What will make the difference in and around Taiwan by 2027 is alliances, submarines, bombers, and cruise missiles. If the United States can maintain a strong alliance poised to defend Taiwan, that would be U.S. forces, Australian forces, Japanese forces in certain places at certain times, in certain roles, potentially British forces, maybe a smattering of other European allies, the Philippines, potentially. If the United States can keep this alliance together, and keep it pointed at Taiwan, at the Taiwan Strait, then that alliance in aggregate is still more powerful than anything, any kind of force China can mobilize to try to cross the strait. I'm especially focused on submarine deployable submarine numbers, cruise missile stockpiles, and long range bombers. Multiple war games over the years have underscored that submarines and bombers firing cruise missiles are the critical capabilities to defeat a Chinese invasion fleet before it lands a decisive force on Taiwan. As long as the United States and its allies can get a few dozen submarines into the waters around Taiwan ahead of the invasion, and as long as the U.S. Air Force can get 100 bombers in the air with an arsenal of, I don't know, 10,000 to 15,000 cruise missiles and anti-ship missiles, then it's still going to be a close fight. But it will be at that point a fight the Americans, the Taiwanese, their allies can win.
A major initiative under Biden was the AUKUS pact involving the US, UK, and Australia, most notably in an effort to equip the Australian fleet with nuclear-powered submarines. And that's first by selling American Virginia-class SSNs, attack submarines, to the Aussies in the 2030s, with a new SSN for the RAN, the Royal Australian Navy, built in cooperation with the UK to enter service in the 2040s. How solid does that plan look as we head into 2025? I mean, can the US Navy actually afford to sell its own submarines to the Australians and then wait for replacements to be built?
I tend to think that AUKUS is going to be Trump-proof because so much of it is a commercial relationship between U.S. and foreign industry to build up naval shipbuilding and maintenance capabilities in the United States, the U.K., and Australia. Hey, man, look, if money is flowing, Trump is not going to be inclined to meddle in it. And also, Trump's politics seem to be antagonistic toward China than toward Russia, where he has this kind of strange fondness for the authoritarian Putin regime. So I don't see anyone messing with AUKUS. If AUKUS is going to fail, it's not going to be because one US president or some prime minister here or there is skeptical of the arrangement. It's going to be because the consortium doesn't have the resources or can't act quickly enough to deploy its capabilities in a way that's relevant. It's the fact that Australia is not going to get its SSNs until the 2030s, that's problematic because, you know, as many people are predicting, we could see a conflict around Taiwan years before we see the AUKUS consortium deploying more and better submarines in meaningful ways. So the big problem with AUKUS is not necessarily the politics around it, it's the timeline.
Looking at specific arms of the US Navy, how do you think things are going with the following as they shape up for the future? And in each case, how do you think drones will be in terms of significance? And by that, I mean in the surface force, the submarine force, naval aviation, and the US Marines.
So the problem with the US Navy Surface Force is the problem the Surface Force has always had. It can't build cruisers. We've been trying for a generation to build a large surface combatant with the command capabilities, the sensors, and the magazine capacity of the old Ticonderogas. The Ticonderogas are slowly going away. There's only a handful left, and they will be gone in the next 5 years. And the only thing to replace them are Burkes, more Burkes, the same, albeit upgraded, the same destroyer that we've been building since the early 1990s. The US Navy needs to get its act together. Design a large surface combatant that it can build in meaningful numbers and quickly, and build the damned thing. It is embarrassing that what should be the world's leading fleet cannot design and build a new large surface combatant. The Constellation frigates are, by all accounts, a solid design that should be relatively affordable compared to a Burke. We're talking about $1 billion plus for a Constellation versus $2 billion plus for a new Burke. But these frigates are years behind schedules owing to design changes and the fleet-wide or the industry-wide naval shipbuilding labor crisis. So the Constellations aren't unique in being late, but they are late. Surface Force is a mess. Submarine Force is, well, also a mess. We have the same delays in delivering new submarines that we're seeing with frigates, because the industry can't recruit and retain skilled workers in the numbers they need to build the boats that are already on order. Never mind building more boats. The submarine force is still shrinking, albeit slowly, and won't begin to grow again. It will bottom out at around 45, 46, 47 boats in the coming years, and then should begin to grow again in the years following through the 2030s and 2040s. The objective, of course, is for a 66-boat attack submarine force, and it's going to take until 2050 at the best to reach that goal. This is a problem that has been 30 years in the making. Submarines are not something you can order up quickly and cheaply. And the policy of multiple administrations through the 1990s and early 2000s to deprioritize submarine construction is why we have more old boats leaving the force now than we have new boats coming in. You add the labor crisis and the delays and this dip in submarine numbers, it has only become more dire and persistent. So, it's bad. It's real bad. Naval aviation. I would say naval aviation's in pretty good shape compared to the surface force and the submarine force. The Navy has, adequate numbers of relatively new Super Hornets and P-8 patrol planes. And new Hawkeye radar planes, the Growlers are still going strong. Yeah, the Navy is doing fine, maintaining its nine deployable carrier air wings plus the patrol force, and integrating new capabilities such as the MQ-25 tanker drone. This is all very encouraging. We are finally seeing the fruit of a years-long effort to boost the throughput at the aviation depots to get those planes fixed up and back to the fleet in time. So naval aviation's in pretty good shape. There's a new fighter program coming down the pipe to eventually replace the Super Hornets and to complement the new F-35Cs and F-35Bs. We'll see what shape that takes, but yeah, I would say rare bright spot relative to the rest of the fleet. U.S. Marine Corps is experimenting with some fascinating technology and concepts. I believe the Marines are on the right track. They've been shedding heavier capabilities such as tanks and tube artillery and replacing that force structure with these new littoral forces, drones, including the Marines' first Reaper drones, semi-robotic wheeled launchers for anti-ship missiles, and also more high-mobility artillery rocket systems, wheeled rocket launchers with a growing array of munitions that combined give the Marines a credible, quickly deployable, low-footprint counter-shipping capability that they lacked as recently as a decade ago. Finally, the Marines can fight a credible counter-shipping campaign in the Western Pacific in order to put the squeeze on some of those maritime bottlenecks that could significantly boost U.S. Navy and allied efforts to bottle up the Chinese fleet in the Western Pacific. This is all very encouraging. If anyone's letting down the Marines, it's not the Marines, it's the Navy, which has promised to provide the Marines 31 deployable amphibious ships, but has consistently failed to keep that amphibious flotilla in good material condition, fully manned, fully ready to deploy. I don't know the last time the Marines were able to deploy all of their planned amphibious ready groups, each of which should have three vessels, enough to support a Marine battalion, to land and support a Marine battalion. I can't remember the last time one of those ARGs deployed with all of its ships and on time. The Navy is breaking its promise to the Marines to provide the amphibious shipping the Marines need to get troops moved around the world.
Can you think of any other observations you'd like to make before we wrap things up?
I would say, buckle in. The world is not getting any more stable, and voters in the world's leading democracies are not getting any more sane. So we're in for a rough few years or generations or rest of our lives. So yeah, cross your fingers, pray to whatever God you believe in. It's going to be rough.
Thanks, David, for coming on the podcast again and providing your insights and wise words on the US Navy.
Thanks.
And I'd just like to remind people at the end of this episode that the Guide to US Navy is on sale in the USA, the UK, and globally, and you can get it direct from the publishers, Sundial Magazines, as well as look for it in shops. And it's well worth a look. I know I'm biased in that I'm saying that, in that it's 96 pages of amazing photos, analysis, commentaries, ship profiles, unit profiles. It's action-packed and well worth a buy, in my opinion. And when it comes to the monthly edition of the magazine, of Warships International Fleet Review, the January edition is the current edition out from 20th of December, selling in the UK and globally, including, of course, the USA and other markets. And that is also well worth a read and includes a look at the UK's latest defence cuts, such as the warships that were discussed in the podcast that have been dispensed with. Also in there, also relevant to the podcast, is something on the naval impact of the Donald Trump comeback as president, along with more on the Ukraine war. The head of the Pakistan Navy is also interviewed there. That's well worth a read. A profile of a new Italian patrol ship, and much, much more. And I heartily recommend it. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook. And in both cases, that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.